on manifolds. If we want to start going beyond general relativity, not only including all sorts of matter fields, but perhaps even extending Einstein's gravity itself, we want to have some way of describing a Lagrangian approach, or at least that's convenient as a way to do this. So that's basically going to be the topic of today's lecture. So if we think about an action principle, usually we would have S was the integral of a Lagrangian with respect to time. So the Lagrangian would depend on, say, a set of positions and velocities, and it's the kinetic minus potential energy. Well, obviously, that expression, just as it stands, is not relativistically invariant because you're integrating with respect to time. You've singled out a direction. So clearly, you want to move to something like an integral over all the coordinates that you've got, where this now becomes a sort of Lagrangian density. However, what does that mean? What's the integral of d4x? So under a change of coordinates, that's not an invariant object. So if I change coordinates, I get the Jacobian, I get the determinant of the coordinate transformation. So what I really want to do, if I have an integral, I want this thing to be a covariant object or a scalar. I don't want that to depend on my coordinates. That means I've got to change what I mean by d4x. So I can't just use the straight space-time coordinates. On the other hand, if we think about what can we do to it, to change it, if you think about it, what you're trying to do, if this is a density, you want to integrate it over some volume. So you'd like this thing to be an incremental piece of volume, space-time volume. And of course, you know that the volume is going to sort of think about proper distances. So this is sort of suggesting to you that you really need something to do with the metric in there because you want to have a volume infinitesimal here. So what you want is something that involves the metric. It hasn't got to be a scalar because, in fact, it has to transform. It has to change under a coordinate transformation. But obviously, you don't want it to have any free indices. So an obvious thing to try is to take the determinant of the metric. So that's something which is a number in a particular basis. So it doesn't have any free indices. And it's not going to be covariant. You've had to choose a basis to write it down, so you would expect that it's going to change if you change your basis. So if I change coordinates, then my determinant transforms like the inverse of the coordinate transformation squared. So that's how my determinant changes. So if I took the square root of the determinant, then overall, the combination root g d4x will be invariant. So by this, I simply mean the components of the metric in the new basis. So we just usually write shorthand here. This is shorthand for determinant of g mu nu. Just, it's obviously quicker to write. So this now is a truly covariant expression for an infinitesimal volume. Adding in the determinant of the metric has correctly allowed you to take care of the sort of proper distance aspect. You expect the volume to be a sort of infinitesimal proper distances. So now what we want to do, if we've replaced this here, we've added in a root g, then normally, when we look for equations of motion, you use a variational principle. You vary your action with respect to your degrees of freedom and ask that it's stationary. So now what we want to do is to think about varying the action with respect to the degrees of freedom. And if we're dealing with gravity, the only degrees of freedom we've got are the geometry, the distances. So here, our degrees of freedom are the components of the metric. So we need to know how to vary this determinant of g with respect to the metric. So there's various ways of working this out. So the one I'll use is that for a matrix, our determinant can also be rewritten as the exponential of the trace of the log of the matrix. So if I want to vary my determinant, then I need to vary exp trace log. But we know how to vary an exponential. It's just the exponential times the variation of trace log. And of course, the variation of log is m inverse delta m. So that's how we can find the variation of det. We see that it's just det m times m inverse delta m. So that allows us to vary det g. So if we apply this to our delta of root minus g, the minus sign is there because in four dimensions, with you've got time having the opposite sign in the metric to space, so you take the determinant as negative. I may at times forget to put the minus sign there, so don't worry about it. Either add it if it bothers you. It's really just root g. So we know that if I want to vary a square root, you simply take 1 over. Then we've got a minus sign. I've got to vary g, but I've just seen how to do that. So that's g. And then it's the trace of m inverse delta m. So g inverse delta g. So now I know that to vary my determinant, I simply get a half times square root g times the metric itself. So if I think about what this tells me if I think of a simple source. So this will be something you've already met, presumably in basic field theory or standard model. If we just think of a massless scalar field, then our Lagrangian, or our expected Lagrangian, would be a half grad phi squared. Okay? So normally, you're doing this when you've met this. So far, you'll have been working with fields in flat space-time. So now let's look at what changes once you have a curved background. So if I write this out in full detail, you can see here that your variables are the metric and the scalar field. Now, there's a reason I wrote this extra line here, changing our variable from GAB to its inverse, and that is once you look at situations where you've got matter fields, when you look at the kinetic terms, you're always taking inverse components of the metric, because these are the differentials, these are what's telling you how phi varies. And so you need to have the inverse metric to get a scalar quantity. Therefore, it makes more sense, since the metric's invertible, whether you decide that G or G inverse is the fundamental quantity, is to some extent interchangeable. So that's why I wrote that last line. In practice, you always vary with respect to the inverse metric. So from that, I know how to vary my action. This bit is fairly straightforward. I'm going to get a delta GAB times phi comma A phi comma B. And then I'm going to have two delta phi terms, which are essentially the same. So if I vary my action, and then I know how to vary root G as well. So it's delta of a half grad phi squared. So that's going to be equal to times my measure. So if I move that in and just simply do it one piece at a time, that's a half delta GAB phi comma A phi comma B root G. Then I vary it with respect to phi. And then finally, I vary it with respect to root g. So you see that I still maintain my volume factor of root g. There's a common root g floating around inside that bracket. And I can peel off, remember that the variation of the action is equal to the integral of delta s delta phi root g d4x plus, sorry, delta phi in there, plus an integral of delta s phi delta g ab g delta g ab root g d4x. So I can peel off from that what the derivatives, functional derivatives of the action are with respect to phi and with respect to GAB. So if I pull off the metric one, I get this. Well, if I want to read off the delta phi one, you can see you have to do an integration by parts. So that's the usual sort of trick. And so here I'm going to have minus 1 over root g dA gAB root g phi comma b. Okay. Now, normally you would say, I expect if I set this equal to zero, it should give me an equation of motion. I'm going to hold off suggesting that this gives an equation of motion for the moment, because, we're talking about gravity, and so we might expect something to do with the geometry. But before I move on to that, let me just have a look at that scalar field equation. So you should know what the equation of motion is for a free scalar field. So is it too early in the morning for an audience response? Equation of motion, free scalar. Sorry? The what? Money? Good grief. Forget it. Yeah, well, it's a wave equation, yeah. So it's just a wave equation. So this thing here, we really want that to be a wave equation. So let's just have another look at it. It's 1 over root g. So if you're in flat space, that would definitely be a wave equation, because your g's would be eta's, and you'd simply see it was the D'Alembertian of phi. But here we've got this root g, okay? So let's just think about what happens when our partial derivative meets root g. So note that is a partial derivative there, and if I've trained you well, you should be thinking partial derivative, no guarantee it's covariant, right? On the other hand, you've got this little thing sitting in there, which you know is not covariant either, okay? So if we look at the derivative of root g, we just use this same argument again about debt, the variation of debt is x trace log, etc. So this should be a half, 1 over root minus g times this x trace log, so that's g CD, GCD, A. However, this object here is just a trace of the Christoffel symbol, with the half. So this is just equal to root g gamma a cc. And of course, if you think about what grad a of phi is, it's equal to dA of grad a phi plus gamma AAB grad B phi. So in other words, when I take this partial derivative here, when it hits the G inverse d phi piece, you get that part. When it hits root G, you get this part. And so this top term is indeed the covariant D'Alembertian for a curved manifold. So that is what you would expect for your equation of motion. So this kind of, that's good. Well, really, I say curved space wave equation. It would be the wave equation in flat space if you're in straight, you know, non-trivial coordinates. So you know that, say, the Laplacian spherical polars is different from, you know, it's not just d by dr squared plus d by d theta squared plus d by d phi squared. There's all sorts of extra pieces. So this is how you see what it should be. On the other hand, let's look at this thing here. When you, they must have done some basic field theory. What does this thing inside the brackets ring a bell at all? Yeah. So this looks like 1/2 TAB. So that is very, very suggestive. We varied our action. We've got the variation with respect to the field itself giving us what looks like the D'Alembertian. And when we vary with respect to the metric, we get the energy momentum tensor. So this suggests that we can find an action principle for gravity if we can just find something geometrical, which when you vary it with respect to the metric gives you the Einstein tensor. Okay, so what we're looking for is a scalar and something which, when we vary it with respect to the metric, will give us the Einstein tensor. So an obvious candidate is the Ricci scalar. So remember, Lagrangians are usually kinetic minus potential terms. And so a kinetic term is just a derivative of the field. Now, in our case, GAB is our variable. And the only thing that we know about, really, that has first derivatives of G is the connection. But the connection is not covariant. However, second derivatives, which tell us about curvature, which is also telling us about tidal forces, that is covariant. So that's why we guess R for our sort of Lagrangian density. So if we want to vary R, we know that we are varying the trace of the Ricci tensor. And so now, the variation, remember, we've got this root g in the integration. And the root g just gives us simply minus a half gab times whatever you started with. So we've already got a minus a half r gab. This is going to give us an rab. So that's good. That's the Einstein tensor. So we just need to think about what happens to this piece here. So this is the bit that could give us trouble. So we need to find delta rab. So there's various ways of doing this. You could, of course, just simply brute force it out from the full expression of RAB. I want to do it on the board in a bit less detail. So I'm going to use a technique that you use in general relativity to obtain results, which is called normal coordinates. So all normal coordinates means is that at any point in your space, you can always make the connection vanish. Now, physically, this would be like choosing a local Lorentz frame, so a local freely falling, local inertial frame. So these... Obviously, if you're in flat space, you can choose coordinates in which gamma varies vanishes everywhere. But in curved space, you can only, in general, make gamma vanish at a point. So this is like a local inertial frame. And so the beauty of that is that if your gammas vanish, partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivatives in that frame at that point, and therefore you can get rid of a lot of the extra sort of junk, if you like, in varying the Ricci tensor. So, RAB is the contraction of the Riemann tensor. Well, if given what we've done, this is the obvious thing to start with and to see if it works. So, you know, we want a scalar. We know it's got to have something to do with derivatives of G. The thing that we've met is the Ricci scalar. So that's not to say it's the only thing you could put in there. So I'll kind of hope come back to that at the end, or once I've gone through the sort of details of the sort of basic Einstein relativity. But yes, you can do other things, right? So we know we can write the Riemann tensor in terms of derivatives and combinations of the connection. Now, I haven't written down the gamma-gamma terms because I'm in these normal coordinates. So I'm sort of at the moment just computing delta RAB to point, okay? Now, in normal coordinates, these gamma terms vanish, but the derivatives of gamma don't, because, as you say, in general, you can only make gamma vanish at a point, but it won't necessarily be zero in the neighborhood, so derivatives need not vanish. Now, when you're doing this, you have to be a little bit careful about ordering your indices as well. So I've now got this expression in the normal coordinate frame. But partial derivatives are the same as covariant derivatives in that frame. And the difference between two connections is a tensor, even though the individual connection is not. So this, I can actually say, in that frame, my delta R is equal to grad C delta gamma CAB minus grad B delta gamma CAC. Now I've written down an expression, again, in a frame, but this expression here is covariant. This is now a tensor. So given that what I have now written down is something which is not dependent on a particular coordinate frame, I can say that is the expression that is true in all frames. So normal coordinates is a nice trick. You use it to simplify the expressions you've got. It's also quite useful when you're deriving perturbation theory for GR. The only thing to bear in mind or be wary of is when you've got commas, your partial derivatives, don't flip them. Just sort of be very studious and careful about ordering things. Sorry, there was a question there, but I was just wanting to finish the train of thought.
Yes. Got an expression that is covariant, but it's covariantly wrong.
No. If you've been careful, if you've gone in, what you're doing is you've initially chosen coordinates to derive an expression, and as you've been careful about that particular derivation. I mean, in this case, there's no worry about changing orders of derivatives, but there are situations when there is. So you've at no point actually done anything illegal. So in this case, I've chosen a set of coordinates, I've derived a result which happens to have a covariant expression. So if this is a relation in this coordinate system, which is a covariant expression, it must be true in all coordinate systems. I'll try and think of an analogy where you use something specific to derive a result. Okay, it's not a good analogy, but so Schwarzschild metric. You choose a very specific set of coordinates, right, to describe, to find the solution, and then you look at properties of the solution. So things like the event horizon, that's there, irrespective of which coordinates you chose. It's a different thing here because you're not deriving a formula, but it's the spirit. It illustrates the spirit where you use specific coordinate systems because they're economical, but if you derive something in that coordinate system which you can express as an invariant, a geometric invariant, then that is true. You don't have to worry about the fact that you chose a specific system in order to derive it. So that's the way, that's what's going on here. If you're worried, what you can do is you can write out the full expression.
Yeah.
So, you know. No, that's why I was stressing that little point about being careful about what you were doing. So in this case, it hasn't come up. But when you try and derive perturbation theory, so if you wanted to look at what the wave equation for the graviton was on a curved background, not sort of perturbative flat space gravitational waves, but gravitational waves in a general background, you have to do this sort of variation because you need to vary RAB to get your wave equation for the HAB, it's usually called when it's gravity, graviton. And then you have to, here, you actually want to go in and do delta G inside there. And then, of course, you do have multiple derivatives. So then you have to be very careful to make sure that even within your normal coordinates, you don't commute partial derivatives. So this comma here is maybe misleading because it's not a genuinely covariant partial derivative. It's a partial derivative in the normal coordinate frame, which is the same as a covariant derivative in that frame. And so you can't commute it. It's perhaps one of these things where if you try, you know, you try doing it a few times, it starts to make more sense. Because I can say these things and, you know, you can give people warnings, but sometimes you have to experience it yourself to see why it's true. No, I think if you're honest in this case, you're all right. So, right, where was I? What did I want to say? Well, I think we're more or less done. Okay, so in this case, I need just delta gamma. So I'm using the same rationale today. So I've done the same rationale here for finding delta gamma CAB. I've said that in my normal coordinate system, the first derivatives of the metric vanish. So if I took a delta G here, it would be multiplied by zero. The only way I can get something non-zero is when I've got derivatives of delta G. So, and again, comma is really semicolon in this frame, so I've put in these covariant derivatives here, and this is now a covariant expression. So the only final bit of warning about this is the variation of G, and I want the variation of G inverse. So I'm simply going to have to think of this as a minus. So I've actually deliberately here, rather painfully, lowered the indices with copies of the metric there so that I emphasize this is delta G inverse. Anyway, putting all this together, So I have here, I've written down what delta RAB is, and I know what my delta gammas are. So I've got a GAB, the derivative of this expression here. So I've got now 1/2 So remember, I mean delta G inverse there, right? And then the delta gamma of AAC is simply I've got all the signs right there. So what we've got now is this long string of derivatives of delta G, but notice that, this should have been a grad C here. And this should have had a grad B. Well, they're all second derivatives now. So now if I look in detail in this, the first two terms are the same. So this gives me minus grad A, grad B, delta GAB. And the second two terms are also the same. And this gives me GAB box delta GAB. So this, from the perspective of an action principle, this is a total derivative. So that means that it's not going to contribute to the equations of motion. So what that total derivative means is really that it contributes only a boundary term. So remember, in the Lagrangian principle, you have some sort of volume, and inside you've got some arbitrary delta phi and delta g, but typically you say on the boundary, my delta phi is zero, and my delta g is zero, and I have equations of motion in the interior. Now, I don't want to get into this now, but I do want to come back to it, that just a note, this first derivative is a first derivative of something which is already a first derivative of g, okay? So in this case, if we want to be strictly accurate, we can't just impose delta G as zero on the boundary. We're going to have to say something about the derivatives of delta G. Maybe not all of them, but something about the derivatives of delta GAB. So we'll come back to that. But sweeping that aside for the moment, what we've found is that varying R equals, again, one of these inverted commas equals, the Einstein tensor. So that is up to derivatives. So now we know what to write down and how to pair up this density with the scalar field density. So our gravitational action is therefore, it's called the Einstein-Hilbert action. Tells us what the constant is to get the Einstein equations. And so now we feel like, right, we've got an action principle for gravity. So this is GR. Yeah? No, not as far as a relativist is concerned, Callum. So I defined what I meant by my functional derivative. Why do they do that? Yeah, no, but I mean they do that with, I've noticed that, like, you know, they do that in ADS-CFT when they're sort of defining these. I never learnt it like that. Because root G D4X is the proper volume form, and therefore that's the measure of the space, so you shouldn't be pulling that out. You shouldn't be pulling out a density when you do this, right? As far as I'm concerned, this process here should be giving me a tensor, not a tensor density. So I know I've seen that, but I'm sorry, I think that's incorrect, actually. But people do it, so be warned. This is what seems to happen. The question was, why wasn't there a root G, a sort of 1 over root G here? Okay. So I define my functional derivative as, say, with delta S by delta phi was the sort of the change, right? So delta S equals delta S by delta phi times delta phi root G D4X. That was how I defined my functional derivative. So what you might see is that this term is included in there, okay? And I think that, so as I say, I'm actually slightly confused. That's not the way I learned it. It doesn't necessarily actually make sense to me, because this is the covariant object, this is then a covariant object, and that's what makes sense to me, geometrically. So I don't know why. So, yeah.
Just to get this straight, like, there where you have T phi AB, that's like the definition of whatever you want to couple to the gravitational field.
That's the energy momentum tensor.
Yeah, so it can be like matter or whatever you want.
Whatever you've put in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, of course, sometimes it becomes a little bit obscure, or a bit of a fine splitting as to what is matter and what is part of gravity. So an example I wanted to talk about in terms of extending this action . So there are various ways you can change the action. You can add higher derivatives if you want. You could put r squared, that's another scalar, rab squared, rabcd squared. These are all scalars, geometrical scalars. And you're quite free to add them to the action. They will give you different equations of motion. And some of them are not well-defined theories, so they tend to have unstable modes. But there are other things you can do. Here's another way of changing and finding a scalar. You could suppose that instead of having 1 over 16 pi g as the constant in your action, you could pop a scalar field there. You could say, well, let me assume that my action is phi r. Then delta, you know, once you vary with respect to GAB, you're going to get, remember, phi delta R is going to be phi RAB delta GAB plus GAB times this delta RAB that we just calculated. Let me just make sure I've got my signs straight. So this is what I have. Now, when I try and integrate by parts in this case, I'm not going to get something which is just a boundary term. These derivatives are going to come back to act on the phi field. So if you put this equals sign, which means equals up to a total derivative, I'm going to end up with RAB minus grad A, grad B of phi, plus GAB box phi, times delta G. So this now gives me an example where I've got something somewhat different. And so if I put this in, this is an example of something called scalar tensor gravity. So this is like Brown's-Dickey gravity. If you look at the equations of motion for it, you see that you get phi times the Einstein tensor So what's happened here is you've replaced, to some extent, you end up also that the... Let's write it. What you've done is you've kind of replaced Newton's constant with this scalar field. Sorry, I've got that 2 and 3 mixed up there. I'm having one of these days today. And this, Brands and Dickey introduced this gravity because they were motivated by Mach's principle, which is something that bothered Einstein. It bothered Einstein that his equations of motion were not somehow either fully geometric. There was a sort of compromise. You ended up having something that described the manifold and then sort of put ladling on your matter on top of it, sort of not quite a brute force way, but I think he would have perhaps liked it all to be sort of part and parcel of the same thing. And in particular, there's this sort of idea that if you have a bucket of spinning water, that the water will shoot up the sides of the bucket. But what is it, you know, what defines the inertial frame, which is telling a bucket in an otherwise empty universe that it is spinning? So what Mach's idea was that the bucket was spinning with respect to distant stars, so that somehow the rest of the matter around us defined the non-rotating inertial frame. But from the point of having the Einstein-Hilbert action, just having an 8 pi g, there's no way you see that. Whereas here, if you put a phi, first of all, this phi couples to the matter that you've got there. So when matter is there, it picks up phi. Phi starts to switch on. And then if you look at the Einstein equation, phi is telling you about the coupling. It's like 1 over 8 pi g. And so as phi changes, Newton's constant changes. And so this was an attempt to incorporate Mach's principle into gravity. Now, it doesn't work because if you try and do cosmology, for example, actually, more importantly, if you're not careful with solar system tests, there's absolutely no evidence for a fifth force, which is what this would appear as. The scalar would be giving you an additional force. So, well, I say it doesn't work. What it means is that the parameter which governs it is very tightly constrained. There's no evidence for a varying Newton's constant. So, but nonetheless, it's like any good idea. It kind of sticks around. It won't go away. And you see that something like this emerges quite naturally. If you have more dimensions, you also get scalar field in string theory, and so having these fields floating around is something which actually crops up quite a lot. And so you kind of need to know how to deal with them. So anyway, that's the end of what I wanted to say. I know I've got a question back there, so let me come back to that. I think. Oh, sorry.
I missed. Why did we want to act on the scale?
Because I'm integrating by parts here. I'm doing a variation. When I integrate by parts, I said I only wanted to let my variation vanish on a boundary. So in order to, I mean, this here, I can't just pull out my delta GAB to find the derivative of the action with respect to delta GAB. I've got to integrate by parts, so this is free. So when I integrate by parts, these derivatives see this phi, which is sitting outside the bracket. The phi multiplied the r, so it's multiplying these derivatives in the variation of r. So when I integrate by parts, I pick up terms involving the derivatives of phi. It's part of my equations of motion. So that's where they come from.